From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Lewis Katz.
And I'm Caroline Batten.
This week on War News Radio, Under Pressure, we speak with a blogger and a filmmaker about recent protests in the Iraqi province of Sulaymaniyah.
Now, I've been there with my camera, and randomly bullets hit everywhere, like next to you, above you, and basically we face bullets and gunshots every day. Like, not every day, but it's been like a 3-4 day it happened.
Then we hear about the February 25th Day of Rage in Iraq.
Bad government. If the government changed itself, like be good government, they won't accept it and let it stay. But I think if this government did not respond to the people, to what the people ask.
Finally, we explore media coverage of the controversy surrounding the arrest of a CIA contractor in Pakistan.
Even if it was mishandled, this man is a diplomat within the embassy, and immunity attaches to him. So no matter how angry you get about something the way it was handled, that's the bottom line.
But first, a roundup of this week.
In response to mass protests on February 25th, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is urging Parliament to pass a law to elect new government officials in Iraq's provinces. The move would allow voters in these regions to elect local councils more than a year before scheduled elections in 2012. While al-Maliki has the support of Parliament Speaker Osama al-Nujaifi, it remains unclear whether the rest of the body will support such a measure. The protests that spurred the declaration were part of a planned Day of Rage, in which Iraqis from around the country came out in support of government reforms, including widespread improvements to infrastructure and government services. Unlike recent protests in the Middle East, demonstrators have not called for regime change. While al-Maliki has publicly stated his respect for the protesters, he has encouraged Iraqis to stay home, warning potential demonstrators that Ba'athists and members of al-Qaeda have infiltrated popular rallies. These claims were quickly disavowed by protesters. At least 29 people have been killed and more injured in crackdowns. Kyle Crawford and Christina Matamoros will have more on the protests later in the show.
The World Bank has given a $400 million debt facility to Zain, a Kuwaiti telecom firm accounting for roughly 50% of Iraq's mobile phone market. The International Finance Corporation, which handles private lending as part of the World Bank, sees the facility, which consists of 6 separate loans, as a means to expand private industry and development in the country. The company intends to use the funds to pay off existing loans and to extend its networks to what it sees as high-potential mobile markets, many of which will be in some of Iraq's poorest areas.
Gunmen attacked Iraq's largest oil refinery in Baji, killing one engineer, wounding 3 employees, and setting off several bombs. Parts of the refinery were shut down as a result of the attacks, but partial operation has been restored so that the refinery is currently operating at 50% capacity. The acting manager of the refinery says it will take months to fix the damaged equipment, including pipelines, cables, and furnaces. Disruption at the refinery threatens to significantly slow the delivery of gasoline and oil to Iraqi residents, since Iraq does not export any of its oil products and instead uses all of its production for domestic consumption.
The Daughters of Iraq, a female security group responsible for patting down women in search of guns and explosives, has not been paid in almost a year. At the group's station in Diyala province, where the female suicide bombing rate is at its highest, the women are having difficulty paying electricity and rent bills due to the lack of funding. The government has said that the lack of payment is due to technical issues. The Daughters of Iraq began in 2008 as a program of the United States military, which, until last year, was responsible for its funding. The group has significantly curbed the female suicide bombing rate in the country, since social customs forbid men from patting down women.
An investigation into the deaths of 9 Afghan children caused by a NATO airstrike has shown that coalition troops were at fault. The strike, which occurred in the Peck district of Afghanistan's eastern Kunar province, was a response to an insurgent attack on a base used by U.S. and allied forces. The location of the insurgents was apparently miscommunicated to the helicopters carrying out the strike, resulting in the death of 9 boys gathering firewood, all of whom were under the age of 13. General David Petraeus, commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, said publicly that it was a tragedy, expressing regret for the families. Petraeus also stated that he would personally apologize to Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Additionally, the general has rebriefed all helicopter crews on minimizing civilian casualties and warned that doing otherwise could result in disciplinary action.
2 security contractors, Christopher Drotleff and Justin Cannon, will stand trial this week in a federal court in Norfolk, Virginia, for the second time after their first case ended in a hung jury. Drotleff and Cannon have each been charged with 2 counts of second-degree murder and 1 account of attempted murder after a shooting in Kabul in May 2009. The men were working for Z Services, the military contractor formerly known as Blackwater, to help the U.S. train the Afghan National Army. The defendants have stated they were driving with 2 other security contractors when a car crashed into them. Significant debate has occurred as to whether the car was actually driving towards them, as the bullet holes were in the back of the car and not the front.
The U.S. military announced that they are repositioning troops in Afghanistan. The major shift will be a partial removal of troops from the Peck River Valley near the border of Pakistan. A spokesperson for the Pentagon told reporters that Major General John Campbell had begun the troop shift in order to achieve greater effect and allow for more flexibility. The area has been the site of intense fighting between U.S. forces and insurgents, and it is unclear what effect the move will have on Afghan civilians living in the Peck region. While some residents think that the violence will decrease if insurgents do not have anyone to fight, others fear that, in the absence of U.S. forces, the area could be taken over by the Taliban.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went before a House panel to defend against a Republican proposal to reduce spending on foreign aid. Secretary Clinton cited the recent turmoil in Libya as an example of why foreign aid was necessary. She told the panel that the stakes are high and that Libya was an unfolding example of how we use the combined assets of diplomacy, development, and defense to protect our interests and advance our values. Secretary Clinton also raised the issue of stability in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, arguing that saving on foreign aid in the short term would eventually lead to larger problems and costs in the long term.
2 U.S. airmen were killed in a shooting in Frankfurt, Germany. Arid Uka, a 21-year-old man from Kosovo, is suspected of killing the airmen and is currently in custody. The shooting targeted a bus carrying U.S. Air Force personnel parked outside Frankfurt Airport. Uka was apprehended by German police while attempting to flee the scene. The airmen were set to begin work on an overseas operation at Ramstein Air Base, which served as a strategic base for coalition forces since the beginning of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is War News Radio. Over the past few months, a wave of protests has been sweeping across Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and many other Middle Eastern countries. Iraqis, who may have been inspired by the Arab neighbors, have intensified their demands for government reform, better public services, and an end to government corruption. In Iraq's northern region of Kurdistan, several weeks of protests have been centered in Sulaymaniyah. Kyle Crawford spoke to blogger Karzan Kurdozi and independent filmmaker Sam Saravan, who have been covering the protests since they began, to learn more about what is happening.
Since February 17th, when members of the ruling Kurdistan Democratic Party fired into 1,000 protesters gathered in front of the ruling Kurdish Party headquarters, demonstrations involving up to 20,000 people have become a daily occurrence in Sulaymaniyah, a city 160 miles northeast of Baghdad. Although there have been protests throughout the rest of Iraq, in cities like Baghdad, Mosul, and Basra, in few places have protests occurred at the daily level like those in northern Iraq. Karzan Cardozi, who has been blogging from the scene, explains why people are calling for change.
Well, I mean, you have to see, like, over here, the electricity. I mean, let's take the electricity. I mean, you have electricity for, like, 7-8 hours a day. And the young people are really fed up, and there's a lot of corruption, a lot of, like, involvement of political party in government. I mean, we have a parliament, right, but who controls these two parties? And they, like, put the people who related to them in a higher position.
San Saravan, a filmmaker who has been documenting the events, describes why he believes people are so upset.
There's no freedom of expression as they claim, as the governments claim. And whenever you want to go on the street, you're not allowed to go on the street to express your feelings.
Kurdistan, which gained autonomy within Iraq in 1991, is generally considered to be safer and more developed than the rest of Iraq. The region even avoided most of the sectarian violence which ravaged Iraq after the U.S. invasion of the country. But critics say nepotism, a lack of public services like clean water and electricity, widespread corruption, and high unemployment have plagued the region. Saravan says that revolution in Egypt and Tunisia fomented opposition against Kurdish President Masoud Barzani and the KDP, Kurdistan's ruling party.
So you see Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, King Ali, and people always have this illusion that this guy will stay until they die and somebody else will take over. And so the young people here, when they see Hosni Mubarak gone, Bin Ali gone, and this scene that people were afraid, like, hey, somebody else could come, there could be more democracy, there could be change, it took over, and people are now going on the street and they demand that.
Protests in the city square have led to clashes with anti-riot police and militias backed by the KDP and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, or PUK party. Government officials say anarchists and vandals have been leading the protests, but most accounts, including Cardozi's and Saravan's, say ordinary citizens, made up mainly of students upset with the government, are behind the protests. Though casualty estimates vary, with perhaps 6 killed and several hundred injured, Saravan says that he often fears for his life when he covers the protests.
You know, I've been there with my camera, and randomly bullets hit everywhere, like next to you, above you, and basically we face bullets and gunshots every day. Like, not every day, but that it's been like a 3-4 days. It happened.
The Kurdish parliament condemned the use of force against protesters. But even after the statement, anti-riot police and militias, led by the ruling party, clashed with protesters, shooting and killing several and injuring hundreds. Here's Cardozi explaining how the anti-riot police and militias act.
The cockroaches, they refer to them as Kalancha, which means cockroaches, is the anti-riot police. You know, they're everywhere, they dress in black and they carry a stick, which is like electrocuted. I mean, they start throwing water into people and they electrocute people. Those guys don't shoot. The people who shoot are militias. And nobody knows who these militias belong to. I mean, just people dressed up as civilians sometimes in uniform, and when riot break out, they start shooting into the crowd.
Masoud Barzani, president of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, has called on protesters to respect the democratic process in place in the region. And in a written statement, he said that the votes of the Kurdish people should determine the path of the country, and protests by a few are irresponsible attempts to impose their will on others. However, Cardozi says that people in Iraq just don't trust politicians.
Well, nobody really believes it. I mean, over here, I mean, parliament and government and political party, people take them as a joke, really. I mean, they make many promises for many years, and nobody ever believed them anymore.
Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube users have been crucial in spreading information about the protests and sharing photos and videos from the unfolding events.
So within, like, a few hours from the protest, when you come home, you have, like, many pictures and video of the day's event. And that's how people communicate. And they would pose like, hey, today we're going to meet here. Today this is a plan. Especially like the university students, they have their own group.
At the moment, it is unclear how long people will continue to gather in Sulaimania's main square to protest the current government. Saravan says that if the government doesn't start to address the protesters' demands, the intensity of the demonstrations will grow.
I think if the government don't respond to the people's demands and what they have asked, as far as I know, it might get tougher for them. Like it might be violent in the future if they don't have any response.
Protesters in Sulaimania plan to continue demonstrating until the government takes action, and smaller protests in other Kurdish cities are occurring as well. You can find a link to Karzan Kardozi's blog, The Moving Silent, on our site, as well as links to videos taken by San Saravan. For War News Radio, I'm Kyle Crawford.
This is War News Radio. On February 25th, across Iraq, the Day of Rage protest took place. In roughly 20 cities across the country, Iraqis came out in the thousands to protest high unemployment, corruption, and a lack of basic public services. 8 years after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq ousted Saddam Hussein, Iraqis say the new government is failing to provide even the most basic services. Christina Matamoros and Kyle Crawford have more. Here's Christina.
After security forces clashed with protesters on Iraq's Day of Rage on February 25th, news report counted up to 29 people killed and hundreds injured. Demonstrations have continued every day since, and major protests are scheduled to take place in the upcoming weeks. Hussein al-Sudani goes to medical school outside of Najaf in southern Iraq and explains what the protesters are demanding.
I think the main thing that the people are protesting for is to getting the real democracy. Real democracy and to change the government, the bad government. If the bad government change itself, like be good government, they will accept it and let it stay. But I think if this government did not respond to the people, to what the people ask.
Demands include greater political freedom, an end to corruption, and better public services. Many were surprised when government forces shut down roads leading to Baghdad's Tahrir Square. This greatly affected the number of participants in the protest because anyone that wanted to take part had to walk to the square. Nabil Salih, a 19-year-old student living outside the city, could not attend the protest because the roadblocks would have forced him to walk there.
They blocked the roads and they don't let people to reach Al-Tahrir Square.
Human rights organizations and the United Nations representative to Iraq have expressed concern about the use of violence against protesters. Nabil believes those responsible for attacks on civilians are forces not related to the National Army.
These guys I'm telling you about, they harmed them and they used real bullets to hurt the protesters.
Iraqis have had a keen eye on the protest happening in other parts of the Middle East, especially in Tunisia and Egypt. Michael Hanna, a Middle East expert and a fellow at the Century Foundation, a nonpartisan, nonprofit public policy research institution in the U.S., says,
I don't think we would have seen the level of protest and uprising that we're witnessing all across the region if it hadn't been for Tunisia.
According to Hanna, the revolts in Tunisia were the starting point for all the following protests in the Middle East. Nabil Sali says that Iraqis gained inspiration from the revolutions occurring in other Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, it was very inspiring and made us feel like it's time to change it, to change how we live and how we accept the government actions, and like to call for our rights.
Like in other Middle Eastern countries, social networks played a major role in organizing and recruiting protesters. In Baghdad, the Day of Rage was organized by users of the Facebook group The Iraqi Revolution, which has about 30,000 members.
Facebook page, the Iraqi Revolution, they made a plan how the people go to the protesting in Al-Tahrir Square, but next day on Friday, they were surprised by the government action.
Al-Sudani believes that Facebook is one of the only mediums showing people the truth about the situation.
But Facebook and the people are showing by videos and pictures, they are transferring the truth for the people.
Upcoming demonstrations are already on the protesters' agendas. For days after the Day of Rage, people continue to protest against the government for shutting down major roads and using violence against civilians. Hussein al-Sudani describes the anger felt on the Iraqi streets these days as increasing because the government is challenging the people, and predicts protests will continue to increase in number until the government decides to implement some reforms. For War News Radio, I'm Cristina Matamoros.
This is War News Radio. The U.S.-Pakistan relationship has had its ups and downs throughout the years. The most recent dispute has drawn angry crowds into the city streets of Pakistan, demanding that a detained CIA operative be hanged. Aaron Moser analyzes the situation through its major media coverage.
At the end of January, Raymond Davis, a U.S. citizen living in Lahore, was arrested for the murder of two Pakistanis. Davis fired 10 bullets as he killed two people in a busy intersection in Pakistan's second-largest city. Weeks after, it surfaced that Davis is a CIA contractor. The U.S. is demanding his release, and the Davis case has become a volatile point of conflict in an already tense relationship between the two nations. When the story first emerged, U.S. media sources were reporting that Davis was a common diplomat who had ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time, and echoed the government's claims of diplomatic immunity. CBS reported that Davis worked for the embassy.
Facing a possible death sentence, Raymond Davis has been catapulted from an obscure job at the American embassy in Pakistan to the center of a diplomatic meltdown with a critical ally.
Democrat John Kerry of the Senate Foreign Relations Council reiterated this message in his trip to Pakistan.
Even if it was mishandled, this man is a diplomat within the embassy, and immunity attaches to him. So no matter how angry you get about something the way it was handled, that's the bottom line.
However, a week after Senator Kerry's trip to Pakistan, U.S. media outlets began reporting what they had known all along. Davis is a CIA operative. On February 21st, the New York Times published a piece that said that their organization had agreed to temporarily withhold information about Mr. Davis's role at the agency at the request of the Obama administration, which argues that disclosure of his specific job would put his life at risk. Mark Mazzetti, journalist for the New York Times, explains Davis's specific job in an interview with MSNBC.
Well, Ray Davis is a, as we said, a contractor for the CIA. He's a security guard working out of a safe, was working out of a safe house in northern Pakistan in Lahore with another number of other contractors who are protecting and supporting the sort of task force up in that area who are monitoring militant networks in northern Pakistan. And it's an area that the ISI, Pakistan Spy Service, is particularly concerned about because some of the militant groups that are operating in the area that the CIA is spying on actually have been supported by the ISI.
The day after the New York Times report, the British news organization The Telegraph published an article with the headline, "Raymond Davis was acting head of CIA in Pakistan." The media coverage surrounding this case has been difficult to decipher. The Guardian published an article with the headline, "Truth Hard to Find in U.S.-Pakistan War of Words Over Raymond Davis." Even harder than finding truth in the case has been finding common ground between U.S. and Pakistani governments. Even after the admission that Davis works for the CIA, U.S. officials have called for his release. According to the Pakistani newspaper Dawn, the Pakistan government offered to release Davis in exchange for the release of Dr. Afia Siddiqui, a U.S.-trained neuroscientist serving an 86-year sentence for attempted murder of an American soldier in Afghanistan. The Telegraph reports that the U.S. rejected the deal, demanding Davis's transfer to U.S. custody. Pakistani officials have denied these requests, insisting that the case will be settled in local courts. Davis's fate has yet to be decided, and the implications on the future relationship between U.S. and Pakistan remain unclear. But when Davis is due back in court on March 8th, many people will be looking for answers. For War News Radio, I'm Aaron Moser.
Our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Eliana Biscard Church, Alan Zhao, Rosanna Kim, Jeremy Rappaport-Stein, Sam Hirschman, Amandine Lee, Jillian Ma, and Colin Smith. I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Lewis Katz. Until next time, thanks for listening.